Welcome to Sentence to Paragraph, a podcast on the space between wordcraft and the writer's life. My name is Darylyn Evans. I'm joined by my co-host, James Stiegel, and Molly Martin. Today is the second half of our interview with science fiction writer Michael Cooper. We had so much fun talking to him that it ended up being an hour and a half long. The first half, if you listen to part A, is focused a little bit more on world building, science and technology, and how he uses those in his writing. And the second half, we're focused a little bit more on writing life and business models and the business of being a writer. So a little bit about Michael before we get back to the interview. Michael Cooper was born in Saskatchewan, Canada, and has been writing short stories since he finished Return of the King and didn't want the tale to end. Michael likes to describe the town he grew up in as being the one featured in American Graffiti, only transported to the 90s, when he wasn't racing stock cars, swapping engines, rebuilding a carb, or porting the heads on an engine. He was surrounded by computers, alternately writing books and software. Michael has operated an ISP, written software that powered whitehouse.gov, built many hundreds of websites, constructed dozens of tables from reclaimed wood, and smashed out over 30 published novels worth of words on his keyboard. On January 1st of 2017, Michael made the leap to full-time author and has been hard at work ever since, crafting the Aeon 14 universe, which now has dozens of novels written by over six authors, telling tales that span 6,000 years. Michael likes to call himself a jack of all trades, but if you get a few beers into him, he'll tell you that he's a future historian. Thanks for joining our podcast, and we'll get right back to the interview.
So one question I had from a craft perspective that I think ties into world building is, could you maybe walk us through how you conceive and develop a character that maybe ties into a story you want to write?
That really, it depends a lot on the character. I actually wrote a foreword to the Rika book that I'm just about finished up right now. And I said that for me, Tanis is like my Artemis, where she was born through strife and struggle. And Rika is like my Athena. She just kind of sprang fully formed from my mind. But what I typically do is I always create the setting first. And I did this even when I was writing fantasy, which at some point I'll eventually get back to. I made the map first. And I said, okay, here's the map, and here's where the rivers go. And I actually understand drainage basins and stuff like that, so my fantasy maps won't get flambéed by people who like that sort of thing. Yeah! Like the rivers go in the middle between the mountain ranges. It's how they actually work. And they don't flow uphill and stuff like that. And so I do all of that, and I think, okay, you've got forests here, you've got mountains here, you know, you'll have these resources, you'll have towns that will form here. What would this town do? Well, this town will be obviously facilitating trade because they're close to the mountains, they're on a river, there's a forest nearby, they'll be running barges down the river and stuff like that. And I create all of that setting, and then I say, okay, I've got this character, and I rough out some background in my mind. You know, like Tanis had been in the military for 50 years, because I thought, okay, but the big thing with Tanis was, what would it be like for a woman to have been in the military for 50 years and then have the military betray her and not let her leave because of her skill set. And that sort of led me into understanding a lot more about women. And I did actually do a lot of research on women because I find women fascinating because they're like another Canadian species that lives next to men. And we have no idea what women are really like. So I spent a lot of time really researching women and their issues and what mattered to them. And I learned things that most men aren't aware of. Like the vast majority of men have never walked into a parking lot at 7 o'clock at night and wondered if they might get attacked. It just never occurs to men to think about that sort of thing. We might think about like 2 a.m. if we're in the Bronx or something like that in the 90s, but we typically never even think of stuff like that. Women think of stuff like that all the time. You know, women are constantly dealing with the fact that they, and it's different at different levels of the spectrum, but they don't get paid as much as men do. And like, what's that like for an entire group of people who don't get paid as much as men do, who are just due to pure physical reasons are typically more afraid in dangerous situations than men are. What does that do to your psyche? How does that make you behave? What kind of sort of bonding events does that create between them? And I said, okay, now let's go 2,000 years in the future where none of that happens, where women are actually, because of modifications, are just as strong as men. I mapped out one of the things is that testosterone is not that useful at later stages of civilization's development, because it basically, testosterone makes you overconfident, and a lack of testosterone makes you underconfident, which is actually one of the issues that women have. There's been studies that have shown that women don't get pay raises as much because they just simply don't ask for them. And men are overconfident because of testosterone and ask for them more. And so the company thinks, well, the cost of retraining someone is more than the cost of the race, so they give it to them. So there's all sorts of things like that. And I said, what if none of that exists? What would women be like? And one of the problems we have right now in modern society is if you take a woman and you give her the same social and personal attributes as a man, people say, well, she's just a bitch. And which I don't think is a fair thing to say, but it's sort of what would happen when you're trying to create a character that you want people to read. You get like the Martha Stewart, you know, where people look at her and they say, well, she kind of looks like a bitchy woman. I'm like, yeah, but if it was a man, no one would say that about her. They would just say she's confident and she's controlling the situation around her. So I worked really hard to create a character in Tanis that had all of these attributes that we would typically associate with a strong man, but still resonate with women as a woman. And that's a really long answer to say that's how I crafted that character. And to be honest, she sort of started the whole thing. Once I had her, people really liked her. I had a lot of women that wrote me and they said, thank you for portraying a woman this way in your stories. And I realized that sort of would set the stage for how I was going to write all of the future women. And I think one of the big things, I didn't even realize it at the time, was that Tanis never asks a man's advice. And she never says, what should I do to a man? She always says to the man, this is what we're doing next. And that alone was such a different thing from a lot of books that it sort of set it set up everything from there on out, actually, for how all male female interactions worked in the series. And it's also aided by the fact that women outnumber men 7-1 in Aeon 14. So there's a lot of different dynamics that happen that way as well.
Well, and it's funny, you know, something I just know from being part of the paying attention to the fans and things like that is that it's actually been something when we think about world building that some readers have a hard time accepting. They have a hard time coming around to it and they try to criticize, you know, those details, which is very interesting to me. You know, yeah. When you try and write something from outside the current perspective and how people, readers especially, fight against it.
Yeah.
And I think it's a interesting nuance as well, because when you speak about really focusing on entertainment and wanting to write something that's entertaining, but still kind of weaving in these details to maybe ease some people over to another way of thinking that they might not have come from, especially in military science fiction. Because something I've noticed in military science fiction is that a lot of people sort of use that genre to kind of, I think, burrow back into, norms that they don't want to see challenged in other science fiction. You know, so that that's something that I think is difficult to do. And it's, I don't know, it's something you just how you went through that explanation. Like sometimes you got to make that explanation so that people get what you're trying to do.
You know? Yeah. Like I have a lot of covers, for example, on my books that, where the women are dressed, it's sort of like the tropey science fiction scenario, but there's actually a number of scientific reasons why I did that. For example, like the new spacesuits they're working on for Zero G are actually basically cat suits. And the reason why they're doing that is because if you put pressure on the shoulders and the heels, you can actually stop a lot of the calcium losses in the human body. They also function as vacuum capable outfits and stuff like that. And they're also, it also even came from the fact that they did some research and they determined if we ever go to Alpha Centauri, we're going to need to bring something like 100 tons of clothing along. And they said, we're probably going to have to invent spray on clothing that you can actually wash off and then reuse or something like that. And so I thought that actually all fit into it. But then I also thought to myself, well, what if in the future, everybody can have whatever body they want? And we're far less constrained by a Judeo-Christian Muslim morality telling us that we should be ashamed of our bodies. So you can have whatever body you want, and you are now 2,000 years away from the last time someone ever said you should be ashamed of your body. What would people do? You know, we see it. We're starting to see it now with the tattoos, like how many tattoos people are getting and how there's tattoo models who cover their bodies in tattoos and stuff like that. And how it's because there's now at least a segment of society that feels no reason to be ashamed of their bodies. And what that's doing to how people behave and portray themselves. And I actually believe I softball a lot. I think it would actually be a lot different than what I present, but I have to change the way I tell the story a little bit, so that the modern reader isn't just completely blown away by the fact that people have modified their bodies so much. I believe that probably in 2,000 years, you'll see most people won't even be recognizable as human anymore if they wanted to. And because it'll become something as simple as outpatient surgery, it'll happen all the time.
Yeah, transhumanism is pretty crazy. Yeah.
And that's sort of that's a very hard thing to get people to wrap their minds around. So I have to like sort of squeak little bits of it into the story as it goes.
So how, it sounds like you kind of have a built-in writers group because you have all of these writers working within your field. But in terms of writing your own material, what does that look like for you? Do you work with a writers group? Have you in the past? Or it sounds like your wife is an amazing writer who gives excellent feedback, which normally we would say don't give it to somebody who loves you, but yeah. Like she's not afraid to you've...
Yeah, I'm in this somewhat of a strange scenario where I have a wife that is also a writer and isn't afraid. I mean, she's a little bit afraid to give me critical feedback. I sometimes react badly. At least I used to. I like to think I've evolved a little bit at this point. But she and I actually met in a writer's chat room back in 1997. So we actually met through writing. So it's sort of been a core part of our relationship the whole time. And she's very good at explaining why she thinks certain things about my writing, which is helpful as well. Because some people are just like, I didn't like it, and they don't know why. Or they pick the wrong reason why they didn't like it, and they can be very destructive to your writing. So when I first started, I was very lucky to have her. And I had one other beta reader who read a bunch of my stuff as well. And she gave me really good feedback on... Actually, it was really interesting because just having these two people, I was able to see that entirely different things mattered to them about where their story was going. And I realized if I had had just one person, I might have actually skewed the story in a crazy direction because one person thought that, another one didn't. There's actually a thing called the rule of six, where if you take something, it's used in software UX development a lot. If you take something you put in front of six people, they will identify all the major flaws. You don't need any more than six people. Anything that's really major will come up. And if only one person brings it up, you can discard it. Only if you see like a bunch of the people across the six bringing up a particular issue, just is it something you really need to worry about that much? Unless, of course, you know, you think that you want to change it as well for other reasons. So that did help me out a lot. But as I've gone further on in this, I've realized that mother knows best. You know, I know the best way to move my story forward. I might make some mistakes, but I've also sort of crafted this grand vision for where the whole thing's going. And nobody else really knows that. Like, not even James knows where everything's going. At least I don't think he does. He might have figured it out. but I realized that I can't let people guide my direction because of that. And that's the thing I told a lot of authors. In fact, I read an article about it not too long ago that said get all those other people out of your office. People that are in your head telling you what you should and shouldn't be doing all the time in your story. Get them out of there because at the end of the day, it's your story. And it's the story you're trying to tell, and that's the most important thing. You know, they might have advice on how to tell that story, but when it comes down to it, it has to be something that you're passionate about and you're interested in. And that's sort of a big thing for me now, is that in my process, is that it is my story. And no one actually sees my stuff until it's actually like the final proofing is the first time any fans ever see it. I have a group of fans that do the final read-throughs before a book comes out, and they find all the typos and stuff like that I introduce after the editors go through it. but yeah, it's sort of how I do it now. But I do think that it is important when you're starting out, at least, that you need to have someone who doesn't pull any punches, who can basically say you're telling here, you're missing an opportunity to really show you what the character thinks about something by just telling the reader what they think of it, for example.
So what does your writing life look like right now, since you are, I presume, still producing your own books, but also managing or assisting other writers in working in your world? What does your daily writing habit look like?
All day. It's basically what it comes down to. I'm in my chair by 8:30 in the morning. I go till 6 o'clock, and then I go again from about 10:30 to 1 in the morning. And I don't, everything that any of my co-authors work on me with, I read the whole thing. I revise the whole book. I don't think I'm mean in how I do it, but I don't do the track changes anymore. I just take their book and I write over top of it. And the reason why, which sounds horrible, but the reason why I do it, it was actually James's idea, was that we need to blend the voices properly so that the book feels like a Michael Cooper Aeon 14 book when the readers get it, because, you know, one of the things we're trying to do is sell books. So we want to make sure it's the book that the reader wants to read. So now we do that. I write over top of it. So every book that comes out, you know, I've probably done two passes on it, whether or not I'm the author or not, the primary author or not. And then my own books, one of the big pieces of advice I have for writers is you need to write every day. Every day. I don't care if it's Christmas. I don't care if it's, you know, the day maybe you're in the hospital for surgery and you're unconscious, you can't write. But, you know, other than that, you know, as long as you're conscious, you should do a little bit of writing. And the reason for that is that when you take a book, and I'm sure we've all done this when we started out, your first book takes years to write, and you forget half of it. You're constantly having to go back and fix things and align things, and you write a scene, and you're like, oh, shoot, the character already knew that, you know, which I wrote like 9 months ago. But if you write every day and you don't go back until it's done, at least that's what works for me. Some people do have to go back because they have their process that works for them, which is good. But for me, if I go back, I just get stuck in revisions forever. So I write straight through. I can do a 100,000 word book in about 10 days or so. It'd be 14 days, depending on how quickly it's going. And I, because I'm doing that, I won't forget things. I'll always remember what's going on because I wrote the whole thing very quickly. And so I don't have, it allows you to have a book that has really good continuity if you can write it that fast, or if you at least write every day, because it's going to stay fresh in your mind. And when you have that continuity, the revision process becomes much, much lighter, because there aren't big things to fix anymore, because you wrote it sort of in this giant stream of consciousness. Now, there'll be lots of, usually what ends up happening is you have more grammatical prose issues to fix, but you don't have big story issues to fix. And that's the stuff that typically takes the most time. So that's largely what my process is. It's just to get my butt in the chair and to write words. I'm also a very deadline-driven person. So at any given time, I have between 5 and 12 pre-order deadlines up on Amazon. So, and Amazon is brutal. If you miss your pre-order deadline on Amazon, they revoke your privileges for a year.
Oh my goodness.
So, yeah, mm-hmm. So you have to meet those deadlines. So and the deadline, the pre-order time frame on Amazon is only 90 days. So sometimes I'll actually have 12 books that have to be produced in 90 days. And that just keeps my butt in that chair. And on top of that, it's you know, I'm trying to make a living at this, but I'm also trying to tell this massive story. I have this crazy goal. I want to create a story that's bigger than Star Wars or Star Trek. I want to squash them with the size of how big this story is. And I want to make it scientifically accurate and consistent. And I'm going to do it. And it just requires a lot of time in the chair. And if I don't work at it, I won't be able to do this before I die. That's how big this project is. This project will take the rest of my life. And I want to do it.
Wow.
Wow. Yeah.
Well, and I think one of the things, you know, maybe to speak to that is you've also, it's not like you're doing this all on your own. You've managed to either purposefully or just drawn folks to you, developed a team that is all assisting with that. I mean, Molly probably understands this, but like from the Army, the first thing I think about is like, well, what happens if I get whacked? You know, who's going to step in? So I wonder sometimes like, oh crap, Michael is sick. Like, okay, we need to finish this book or something. Like what, you know?
God, don't let the lieutenant have the map.
Exactly. Yeah. But I think, you know, having a huge vision and then also drawing people to assist, but doing it in such a way, and I think we're seeing things in publishing industry right now where there's a lot of folks that develop a brand and then bring other people into it and are just, they are just kind of doing it for monetary. Like they realize there's a train right now, and if you get on the train, you're gonna make some money. But I think having a vision to tell a really huge story goes beyond that. And I actually, the thing I believe is it would even if the train stops, the story is going to keep going and people will stick with it, you know? So that's, I don't know. It's something with the process. Do you think that pulling other people into it has really helped? Has it inspired you? Is it something you'd recommend, or does it like help you lose sleep at night?
That's a good question. It's like one of the things I've learned is that co-authors, for my process, don't make the books come out any faster. It takes me just as much time to go through a co-authored book as it does to go through to write a book myself. Although that is changing, actually. As the co-authors have been doing more books, it takes less of my interaction to make the book what I want. But I'm super OCD about the finished thing that we're trying to develop here. So I do spend a lot of time with it. I think one of the best things about having the co-authors involved is they come up with ideas that I would never have. And a universe that comes from one person's mind is going to be myopic. There's just no way around that. But with all the other co-authors I have now, they're thinking of characters and stories and situations that I would never have dreamed of, and it's making the whole thing so much richer, which is without a doubt the best thing. The side note is that if I am tired 1 month, I can actually, the co-authors can be a couple of books. If the ideas aren't coming, luckily I have some other books that are coming out to keep the train running, because with Amazon, you've got to have releases to keep the whole thing moving. If you don't, you've got to spend a lot more money in advertising. I'd rather build up a giant library of books and have that be the thing that generates the money than having to turn around and put a lot more money back into advertising. That's a big part of it there. But really, I think for me, it was the stories that, like, for example, the stuff that James is writing are stories that I really wanted to tell, but I wasn't going to be able to get to them until 2021. And now we're going to have them all out, you know, a lot sooner. So it's my publishing schedule is planned out to 20 and late 2020 right now.
Wow.
I know.
Sometimes I chafe against it, though. Sometimes I want to write something else, but like I can't. I have to do these other things, you know. So it can be good and bad.
Do you think that came from software development where does it kind of give you a sense of, I don't know, does it help to know where you're going as opposed to a lot of writers, you know, the whole writing into the dark concept?
Well, the other funny thing is I pants everything. I don't plot.
Yeah.
So I have all this stuff worked out, but I don't have any plots for any of these, or any outlines for any of these books. I shouldn't say I don't plot. I don't outline, which I guess depends on your definition of outline. Sometimes I'll have half a page that describes what a book's going to be about. But yeah, in software development, the software development I was doing was you had to predict what you were going to do for an entire year, and you had to meet those deadlines. And you had to do what's called managing risk. So you would actually, tackle things that are more risky first, work out what's called narrowing the cone of uncertainty. The further you go, the less uncertain you should be about all your outcomes and whatnot. So a lot of that did factor into how to write and sort of created this idea in me that I need to know what I'm doing. Otherwise, these deadlines are going to get blown. And I guess after 20 years of writing software, I've had that drilled into me so much that I'm like, I've become very deadline oriented. And I recognize it for me as a person. If I didn't have deadlines, I'd be playing World of Warcraft right now. I would not actually play Overwatch at present. But yeah, I would not be working. So the deadlines, they keep me going, which is good because I don't want to fail at this goal I've set for myself.
So how did you get started at all of this? I mean, you published your first book. Did you know that it was going to be this big, huge rest of your life long project and that you were going to have to map out your stories for years and years and years? Or you just sat down and wrote a story and went, oh, this is something.
The first book I wrote, actually the first book I wrote was a Buffy fan fiction book. So that one doesn't count. That was the first book I ever finished. And that was pretty cool. But the first book I wrote in AO14 is actually now the fourth book. And I wrote it about this character who finds someone from the past and what that does to the future when they find this person from the golden age of humanity and what they know. When I went to write the book after that, I realized I needed to know more about this Tannis character and where she came from and what her background was and whatnot. So I ended up writing the book that is now sort of the first book, which is called Out System. So I knew at that point when that book was published that I did have sort of this larger arc that I was telling, at least. I didn't imagine it was going to be this big. But for whatever reason, with one book published and I didn't have another book for 3 years after that, I wrote the little subheading of an Aeon 14 novel on there. Because for some reason I thought to myself, I'm going to turn this into a thing. And as well as, I guess, and I had this idea more subconsciously than consciously, but I do remember thinking at once that if I say it and I put it out there, that's the first step to making it happen. It's one of those sort of weird manifesting reality things. But in your mind, like if you admit to the thing, if you say it'll probably never happen, you'll probably make it never happen. But if you start treating it like it's a foregone conclusion that I'm going to create this massive series, that's the first step. And the second step is just never giving up. I had that conversation with my daughter. Last week I had a moment where I was just like, I don't know if I can do this anymore. But the prior day, I was helping my daughter with math, and I said to her, the number one feature, number one quality of successful people is not giving up. Because if you give up, you can't succeed. So every successful person doesn't give up. That's the thing you have to do. Nothing else matters as much as just not stopping doing the thing. Because if you stop doing the thing, you'll never complete it. So that's kind of, I don't remember what the question was exactly anymore, but that's but that's sort of, I guess, what kept me going on this whole thing.
I'm really interested in like the story of the story. So you had this story, then you said, this isn't the beginning of this world. I have to go back and mm-hmm. explore this character a little bit more. And then how did you go from there to, I'm going to start bringing other authors into this and I'm going to develop this into a universe where it's not just me, it's other people?
A big part of it actually was the realization that there were stories I wanted to tell and details that need to be fleshed out to keep writing the main story. For example, so James is actually writing books that take place 1,000 years before what is the first book. They're telling this massive backstory that will probably be between 14 and 18 books long, probably. That whole, it's going to be broken into three series. The plural of the word series is series, which drives me nuts. So sometimes I say series is. It's so undescriptive. Anyway, so I realized that to tell the story, to tell Tannis' story as it goes forward, I didn't know all these details. But the only way I could really hash off these details, at least for me, is I would have to write the books. I didn't want to stop this main story to write the books. I realized I need more people to do this, is really what it came down to. And getting James and getting some other folks that are really passionate about the series and about where the characters are going and about the whole setting has really been instrumental in that.
One thing that's been really interesting to me from my series is now a woman named Lisa Richmond. She's now writing a series that kind of has its seeds like both in Michael's series and in my series, and she's combining them together, and that's amazing. Now this new thing is coming out of it, and so that's really cool too. And so she will pop up and ask questions about, various things to work the details out between them, and so we kind of have this mosaic that is starting to take you know, more and more details are getting filled in, and the mosaic is becoming, you know, more and more visible. And at least in these parts of it that I'm working on, which were completely open, and now, you know, things are starting to fill in, and it becomes a story.
Yep.
So that's really cool to me. But, you know, one thing I was curious about is, as we kind of transition, I guess, into business questions. So you had, was it the programmer's background that helped you figure out kind of the best way to work through Amazon and the sales environment that we're in right now? Because it seems like a lot of the process is also related to the sales environment that we're in. And so the rapid, you know, rapid release schedules, getting mm-hmm. readers on board as beta readers, you know, the 90-day pre-order process. I mean, even, you know, when it comes down to like your nonfiction about using Facebook, and then even now, like, you know, we've talked about transitioning away from Facebook and what that looks like for advertising. I mean, I think most authors, even if you're an SF author and can conceive of the things that we're all talking about from a physics perspective, having that business background or even thinking of that or wanting to think about that is something most authors don't even want to engage with. So what drew you to that? Or was it necessity, or is it something you're interested in?
I've, as a software developer, I've built advertising platforms. I've actually worked with a lot of advertising platforms. So like a couple of years ago, I actually had a business where I ran Google ads. It was sort of just a side thing. I started building some software to do it. And I was actually, at one point, I was making $3,000 a month selling other people's stuff on the internet through Google ads. And I actually had this whole website platform called, it was called lookseeclick.com. And it would just price compare across all the major platforms like Yahoo and Amazon and stuff like that. And then I would just get affiliate money off of it. So I had some experience with that sort of thing. I understood how it works. And I understand sort of a more fundamental level than a lot of people do, like really what Amazon is doing in their whole sales engine and stuff like that. And for me, actually, the best thing is it removes a lot of hocus pocus. A lot of authors, they talk about the Amazon algorithm, which drives me nuts because Amazon doesn't have just one algorithm. They have different algorithms that are actually used for different things. And all an algorithm really means is a bunch of code that does a thing. It's basically a mathematical equation, which is all software. So it's a silly term. It drives me nuts. So I was able to sort of cut through a lot of that and say, okay, I understand that these things demonstrably influence these results, and was able to go from there. So one thing that sort of I think is actually a really neat cross between the craft of writing and the business side is that so much art that we look back at and we know that was made by various industry people, it's all about it was created on a schedule in many cases, like the Sistine Chapel. You know, we got a church, we got to paint the roof, and obviously they didn't say like you can't spend the rest of your life doing it. And I'm bad with artist names. That was Michelangelo.
Yeah, that was Michelangelo. Yeah.
These guys were, and many of these artists and composers back then, they had patrons, you know, where they had to produce, you know, for a lore or something like that. They weren't just like given room and board forever. They actually had to do something. And the medium determined so much of what the art was, you know, the Mona Lisa, the roof of the Sistine Chapel, all of these things, the medium created the art. And people, they look now like, oh, it's so awful that we're creating these books on this artificial time frame of 90 days that Amazon's put there. I'm like, actually, I think it's kind of exciting because it's the story that I write now. Just like the guys who were writing serial stories in newspapers 100 years ago, the story I write now is actually dictated by the medium to a certain extent. And if the scenario I was in wasn't dictating these things, I would probably write a different story. And would it be better? I don't know. It might have been worse, actually. I might have put fluff in there that I didn't need to put in. Like I recently produced a book that was my shortest novel I'd ever written. It was 49,000 words. As I was writing it, I was just like, I could put all this other stuff in here, but I think it slows down the story and makes it worse. And not a single reader mentioned the length of the book, and it's like half the length of a lot of my other novels at that length. But I was partially constrained by the time frame. I had 7 days to write this novel, to write it and revise it and get it to the editor so that I could hit my deadline. It actually ended up being a great novel. And as I look back at it now, I'm still pretty sure that if I had more time to write it, I would have written a worse book. It would have dragged in the middle as I dealt with these two side characters, what they were going through. And instead, all we saw was the result of what they went through and the influence it had on everything else. It actually made the end have a much bigger punch. So that was sort of a thing I think is neat about what the world we're in is that it is altering the craft, but it's not necessarily making it worse. It's just making it different. I guess that's sort of how I like doing how I'm okay with doing the business stuff and the writing stuff is I actually like the intersection of the two.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned you brought this up a couple of times that you had to get it into your editors at a certain time. How did you develop your editing team and find people to do that?
That's kind of a thing like what James talked about is really it's not just me writing these books, obviously. I've actually got a process that it all goes through. I have this master spreadsheet that has all the books, who's writing them, when I have to start my work, when I have to be done my work, when the editor gets it, when the editor has to give it back, when it goes to the JIT readers, which stands for the just-in-time readers who read it right before. Like they have like a 2 days, sometimes a day or two to read a book before I have to upload to Amazon. I found if I give them more time, they don't do it. So if I give them like just a day or two, they will actually read a book in a day or two, and then they'll give me much better feedback actually than if they read it over a couple of weeks and forgot the first half by the time they get there. And then it gets up onto Amazon. And actually the final proof from the editor doesn't happen until after the book is released in a lot of cases, just because the timelines are that tight. But the people who pre-order the book and read it on day one, they're ravenous fanatics. So they don't really notice if there's going to be the odd typo in there still or anything like that. And usually the thing that the editors do at the final end is they just clean up. Most of the time they're just cleaning up commas and repeated words. Like the one editor I have, she actually has Siri read the entire book to her. And that's a really great way to pick up repeated words, because you'll spot them a lot more when they're being narrated. You know, if the word stairs is repeated three times in one paragraph, you'll pick it up a lot more if it's narrated. So all of this sort of works together as part of the process. And there's just steps where everybody steps in and knows they have to do a thing. Even the cover designers, there's the date when I request the cover and the date when I need the cover for the book, which is typically 2 to 3 months before the book is written, is when the covers are actually done as well. And it all just sort of flows. And the great thing is that because everybody knows, like all the people I work with, the editors and the cover designers, they know they have this business coming from me. It actually gives them a lot more freedom, where they don't, because they're not worrying like, okay, am I going to have any covers to do this month? They can actually say, okay, well, Michael's booked this time with me 7 months in advance to do this cover, to do this edit. So I will do that time, and then they fill it in. So what ends up happening is they actually really like doing business with me, because I'm basically like guaranteed income for them at this point. And it makes them actually much more willing to make adjustments if they have to as well than if I was just dumping things on them and then, you know, expecting really fast turnaround. I am, from the editor standpoint, I am really good about making sure that they have the time they need to do it. I don't want the editors to do a rush job. I know some people that do things like they drop a book on an editor and they say they need it. So you got a 70,000 word book and they'll say they need it back in 48 hours. I would never do that because I don't want the 48 hour edit of a 70,000 word book. You know, I want the one where you took the 5 days or whatever you needed to work through this thing and give me a good thing. So it really does come down to planning. I'm running a, I don't like to think of it this way because I really do believe that the most important thing I'm doing is making a story here, but it is a production line, you know, where everybody has their spot where they do their thing and they know what's coming and they know what to expect, which I think creates a better product in the end.
So how did you find the editors? It sounds like you use some of the same editors over and over again, or you book them, and that probably sounds like it's really helpful because then they're more familiar with like, these are some of the conventions of this universe.
But how did you first have
those relationships?
I went through a lot of editors trying to find people that were good, quite honestly. And actually, one of the things I learned in this whole process is that no one person is capable of editing a book and having a good book come out of it. It's just not possible. You can't see everything. And expecting a particular editor to go through your book and give you something that has zero errors when they're done is incredibly unrealistic. And some people, they focus a little bit too much on perfection. And what I've learned is that what I want is I want something that that isn't going to cause me problems. It's going to have so few errors, it's not going to give me issues. And I'm also going to find an editor that can do it for a reasonable price. Like apparently there's editors out there will charge you $5,000 or $6,000 to edit a 100,000 word book. But I think to myself, like, are they actually 4 or 5 times better than the $1,000 editor? Probably not. So what I ended up doing is I put a lot less pressure on my editors. I say like, you know what? You're going to make mistakes, and I'm perfectly okay with that. That's why we run it through the JIT readers, of whom there's, but on most books, there's somewhere between 6 and 10 of them. And they'll find all those last little things that get missed. Especially because, you know, an editor, if they go over and over the book more times, they'll actually find less stuff because they know what to expect. They know what they're reading. They're not actually going to be able to do it and find more stuff. Now, some editors have proofers that are separate from them. You know, the editor goes over it, the proofer goes over it. But I didn't really want that because, like you said, I wanted people that really knew the story. So of all places, I don't know if you guys know who Michael Anderle is. I'm in his Slack chat. And I was in the general, and I was kind of frustrated with the editing that I had. And I said, is anyone here an editor? Anyone here that's looking for some freelance work just to do some more editing? And two women, Jen and T, both messaged me back and said that they would do it. And I decided that I was going to go with two editors from then on in because I just would be less worried about whether or not one person wasn't able to do it. And I said to them, I said, if you want to edit for me, you have to go read all these books. And I made them read my entire back library before they could do the editing for me. And now with the way it works is they haven't read it everything now, but now they each one works on particular series and that's their focus and they make sure the characters are consistent and stuff like that. And there's actually been a couple of places now where there's been crossovers. So they've actually looked at each other's edits to make sure that the characters were consistent in the portrayals that were done through the crossover stories. But it's very much like a family that we've kind of created here in some respects too.
It's pretty interesting.
I want to go back. I'd like to transition back a little bit to kind of thinking about craft and process, and particularly like how, if you are writing 100,000 words in 10 days, and
that's like a record, by the way. That's not normal.
Yeah, well, but I presume that you are writing a lot of words every day between your books and other folks' books, and then looking at edits and all of these things. What are things that you do, like in terms of software and physical hands on the keyboard or voice software? What do you use to do that? And also, what do you do to keep yourself healthy as a writer, like preventing RSI, carpal tunnel, or all of those, and, you know, and also just sitting in a chair, or do you use a standing desk? All of those things. What does that look like?
So one of the things sort of that just at the outset is I only work on one thing at a time. I'm not very good at shifting between stories. So, and part of it is because I want to get into a story. I want to be in that story. So I do have to work up my time where, you know, these days I'm only working on this story. Sometimes I'll switch it up. So I'm actually editing co-author stuff in the evening, but during the day, if I'm writing or if I'm doing heavy revisions, it's only one story. I do have a lot of sort of administrative work I have to do. Like I've got to manage my AMS ads. I got to manage my Facebook ads. All the administrative stuff happens first thing in the morning and I get it out of the way. My rule is by 10 in the morning, I have to be writing. So if 10 o'clock in the morning rolls by, I can't pick up any more tasks. I'll usually wrap up what I'm doing, so I didn't waste the time beforehand, but then I'm writing and I write straight through until about 6 o'clock in the evening. And I do sprints. So we have a group of writers and we'll egg each other on, you know, I did 800 words this hour. What'd you guys do? Stuff like that. And, it's a great way to try and, you know, boost your productivity. We've got one of the narrators in there now. So she's actually like logging and like saying like, I narrated 40 pages or something like that. Probably not that much in an hour, but we do that sort of thing, keep ourselves going. So from a process standpoint, I actually have kind of bad carpal tunnel syndrome because I've been writing software for ages, but a lot of the sort of ways to make it so that I don't ruin my body, I learned writing software because I would, you know, I wrote software. I actually worked just as much. I would work 80 hours a week writing software. One of the most important things is get a good mouse. And there is a company called Apple, which does not make any good mice. So don't use an Apple mouse. You will destroy your hand because the things are flat and you're just going to ruin your index finger. You guys can see this. I can maybe send you the links. These are the kinds of mice you should be using if you don't want to destroy your hand. Your hand can actually sit at a natural angle when you're holding the mouse, and you're not twisting your hand like this for the entire day. Trackpads are the worst too. So this mouse is called a Human Ergonomics, made by evmouse.com. These sorts of mice are the best because your hand sits like it's like this at a natural angle. This one's a little bit expensive, but Microsoft makes one for their ergonomic keyboards too. That's a similar idea, that where your hand sits more at a natural angle.
And for those of you who are just listening and not watching this podcast, what Michael just showed us, can you describe using words what it looks like?
So if you're basically, what you're doing is, for all intents and purposes, you're holding your hand vertically, so your thumb is up in the air almost. Sorry, yeah, I wasn't thinking.
Oh no, that's okay.
You were shaking your hand.
yeah. So basically, you're holding your hand like almost like it's vertically on the mouse. It's curved a little bit. But it's more like if you're able to reach out to a doorknob. It's how your hand's going to be holding your hand if you're reaching out to a doorknob. That's how you hold the mouse. And it's a much more natural way to hold your hand. Whereas if you hold your hand so it's flat, you can, even if you're just to do it while you're listening, you'll feel your index finger has a tendon that's straining all along your arm, and your thumb will be doing it as well. And that's where a lot of carpal tunnel comes from, is that strain from that pivot that you're doing all the time. The other thing that if you were to sit up straight in a chair and hold your hands out, so your elbows, you know, your arms are beside your body, and your hands are out from your body about a 90-degree angle. That's where your keyboard should be. If you're anywhere not like that, and your arms and your hands should be straight. So like, you know, from your middle finger all the way up your arm should be a straight line. If it's not like that, you're going to start to ruin your hands because you're going to be twisting them to the sides. And that's like if you're writing on a laptop, you're ruining your hands. Now if you don't write that much, it's not a big deal. But if you're like me and you're writing all the time, you will cause significant pain. I know some writers who started like doing things like 100, 150,000 words a month, and they hit a point where they had to stop writing for weeks because they had actually caused like serious damage to their hands. I really feel very strongly that everybody who's writing a lot needs to use an ergonomic keyboard. And there's lots of them out there. Microsoft makes one called the Sculpt, which like only weighs like a pound and a half. It's a pretty decent keyboard, and it comes with a mouse. It's not going to destroy your hand as well. So what I do is, you know those pads you can get, like the laptop pads that you put on your lap when you're on the sofa? I put my keyboard on that, and that sits on my lap. So that when I hold my hands out, my arms are at a 90-degree angle from my body, and my hands are just resting on this keyboard at a natural angle. And there's and so everything I do when I'm writing is keeping that alignment in my wrists, my forearms as straight as possible, as much as possible, because that is the thing that will eventually destroy you as a writer. And if you can't write, you know, then you gotta narrate. And I don't narrate, which is the other part of your question. And the reason why is that people's speaking vocabularies are their smallest vocabularies. Our largest vocabularies are writing, are reading vocabularies. Middle is writing. Smallest is speaking. And I know that I tried it out. I would choose different words. And on top of that, the narration software can't pick up half the words I speak because I'm saying things like perseverate. It has no idea what that is. Or I'm describing scientific terms that don't work. So I found that by when I narrated, I actually spent just as much time revising the narrated stuff as if I had just written it straight up the first time. So I don't do that. I just write. That's different for me than it might be for other people. I think one of the most important things people should do is experiment and find out what works for themselves. So they're themselves, because we're all different. So it's very possible that what works for someone else is different than what works for me. That's the thing I think that a lot of people get wrapped up in, is someone gives them advice on this is the way you should do it, and they end up just doing it that way. It doesn't work for them. Except for when it comes to your wrists. We all have the same wrists by and large. So treat them with respect.
Get yourself a good mouse.
That's right. Get a good mouse. Get an ergonomic keyboard. Don't twist your wrists to the right. Don't put them on your keyboard. If you're doing that, you're going to hurt yourself at some point. As far as other software use, I actually write everything in Microsoft Word. I'm one of those weird people that loves Microsoft Word. It's my jam. but I can't. One thing I can't stand is I can't stand too much white screen. So my Microsoft Word is actually black. The white part where I write is white, but the whole frame around is black because it's actually themeable. So I'm like a hacker, you know, right? My little black window there. And I'm a big fan of efficiency as much as possible. So I actually write my documents in a pre-formatted, or write my books in a pre-formatted Word document. So it is. So I publish it 5 1/4 by 8 inches because that's what CreateSpace. That was the smallest thing CreateSpace had available when I started. Now you can do 5 instead of 5 1/4. So I actually have a pre-formatted Word document with all the right styles and fonts and everything all set up, and with the offsets and everything. So I'm actually writing on the page that's going to get printed. And I find that to be pretty useful, too, because I actually like the words to look right in the page. I like the paragraphs to break nicely. So I actually will alter things a little bit sometimes to make it so that the finished product, as I'm writing it, is going to look like I want. And that's sort of the way I go. And the nice thing with that is the exact same file I upload to Amazon for Kindle is the same file as I put on CreateSpace. So I don't actually have to do a second step in producing my ebook versus my print book. It's the same file, goes to both places. The only difference is I take the links out of the print version. And maybe sometimes I might tweak the language if there's not an actual link for people to click, because I'm giving them a URL instead. But aside from that, that's the only thing I do. Because I found that, you know, especially as you're getting a lot of books in your library, you know, if you have 30 books in your library and you want to update your back matter and you have a process that requires you to do a different file or a different build, and even if it takes 10 minutes and you have 30 books, you know, and you want to do that every couple of months, you can end up losing days. Or just not doing it as a result. So I streamline that process a lot. So yeah, one of those words, I'm like, what's Scrivener, you know, type of thing, which James is horrified by constantly. But if you do use Microsoft Word and you go to the review tab in Microsoft Word, there's a little link there that says OneNote. And if you click on that, it'll actually create a OneNote page that's tied to that Word document. And it actually sits over on the side of the screen and is pinned there. So you can actually have a great way of having notes that are attributed to just one book. And if you're running Word on Windows and not Mac, because Mac people are second-class citizens when it comes to stuff like this. If you're writing Word on Windows, you actually have drag-and-drop navigation where you can like write out all your chapters. You can just click on and drag it around like you do in Scrivener. Mm-hmm. But the Mac folks don't get that. So that's a bit of the software I use to get things going. And then Spotify, lots of Spotify.
Lots of Spotify.
Yeah. So how about the healthy body part of that? Do you do some? Are you a walking writer? Do you have a treadmill under the desk? Any?
Nope, I don't exercise at all. Zero exercise. If I get the urge to exercise, I just write instead. I am going to start walking again. I've been meaning to do this. I'm going to start riding my bike again. But I've gone actually a year and a half now without a single lick of exercise, other than going to Disney.
Well, you have a 7-year-old, right? Weren't you just at the skating rink?
Yeah, but I guess that kind of counts. But
chasing a 7-year-old around should be its own, like, you know, thing in MyFitnessPal.
Her big thing that she and I do is we watch YouTube videos together. So we love watching fail videos on YouTube. So that's our main thing. My main direction, my dog, we lay down and we watch videos in bed. But to that point, I am very careful not to eat more than I need to for my for what I'm doing. And I've actually, over the last year and a half of where I spend 12 hours a day sitting, I've not gained any weight. So I think I've managed it. I guess I'm lying a little bit. Like I made a garden last year and I moved 3 cubic yards of soil. So I do stuff like that, I guess. But during the winter, pretty much nothing happens from an exercise standpoint. A while back, I learned to stop eating as soon as I start to feel full. So I don't eat that much. You know, I have like a couple of eggs and I have some almonds, you know, and some other stuff like that. And I drink 7 cups of coffee a day. And that's just sort of keeps me going. I'm going to die.
It's more portion control than...
I don't like the feeling of being full. So that kind of helps me out too. And I'm not a big foodie either. In fact, if they eventually invent Soylent Green, I'll be perfectly happy. Just my Soylent Green.
In fact.
Yeah, they do. Yeah,
well, something that's been proven for a little while, you know. Generation go through that.
Well, Michael, one last question I wanted to ask. You've mentioned Slack and some different. It sounds like you're not a member of a physical writing group, but it certainly sounds like there's some online writing groups and things like that. Have you gotten a lot of value out of those relationships? And linking up with writers that way.
So the thing that surprised me the most with co-authors, because that's really what my writing group is. It's the co-authors that I work with. The fact that I'm going through an entire novel. Written by someone else, not just like a couple of chapters here or there, but I really like going through a whole novel and thinking, do the character motivations fit? Are they going to resonate with my readers? Because if I write a character, a weak female, my readers will eviscerate me. So I have to be very careful. Like, does this female behave the way that we've set it up, that women behave in Aeon 14, or is she ever always turning around and asking a man questions? So there's stuff like that that I look for a lot. And so that doing that has caused me to spend a lot of time in the other authors' writing. And I've learned a lot from the other authors about simple things like how to create new and different ways of entering and exiting quoted text, any quotations. I used to always just be very much... I went through a couple of stages, actually. One where I was tagging everything the way you're not supposed to, like he laughed, tagging like that. And then I had all people just said is the only tag you ever need. So I wrote everything that was said, and I heard it narrated. I'm like, nope, not going to do that anymore. So working with James, working with other authors like Zen and my wife Jill, I've learned a lot from how they do simple things like that, like walking in and out of quoted text. How to introduce paragraphs into ways that are less repetitive and stuff like that. That stuff has been really valuable in working with other writers, just simply seeing how they're constructing, the actual prose itself. And sometimes too, seeing the sort of things that they bring up about a character. Like I don't write a lot of physical feelings in my characters. My wife is always writing about like someone's stomach is grumbling or they're feeling queasy or something like that. They feel nauseous, dizzy, a lot of really physical descriptions of how characters are interacting with the world around them. And that stuff was really interesting to see. Like I never describe if my character feels dizzy or queasy. So I started adding stuff like that in and it made it a lot richer. So I've never actually worked with the writing community. Well, I guess way back in 1997 on the chat rooms I did. But it was much more of like a critique, like you're doing this wrong sort of thing and here's how to fix your writing. And what I found in working with co-authors that was a completely different thing from that is simply, how do I write better prose? How do I make it flow better and feel better and describe my characters better? That's been invaluable.
What I was thinking of was how the online systems work, like for Slack or Facebook. I mean, that's great info too. I just, for listeners that might be thinking about like, hey, I'm in a city where I can't find a writing group.
Yeah, some of this came out of doing software development. I worked for a company called Acquia, and my team was spread between the Ukraine and Portland, Oregon. So we only lived on chat. In fact, it was a team of 16 people, and only 2 people were in the same office as me. Everybody else was spread across the world. We got really good at having communicating well using chat. And one of the important rules for us was that if there was a conversation, the conversation was on chat, so that everybody could be involved. Conversations in the real world were detrimental to our progress because a smaller number of people could access those conversations or could look them up. And that's sort of just built into me that chat is by far and large the best way for people to communicate when they're collaborating on things because you got a record, everybody can communicate, people can come and see it later. It has all these great things. So that's just sort of made it sort of the natural choice for me to use chat. And I think it's really great. Like, right, we have a chat room, a general channel where people can sort of talk about whatever and we joke around. We have conversations. We have a sprint channel where we all egg each other on to write more and talk about our what we've got going on. And sometimes we're like, I didn't write anything today. And we're like, it's okay. You know, it happens. And then we have various...
Get to work, slacker.
Get to work, slave. But yeah, I think some sort of... Something that is... And actually, the really important thing about using Slack, which is just another chat program that's out there, is that it's not Facebook. That's like the most important thing about Slack because everything that happens in Slack is about our writing work, or you know, some small personal stuff is in there. But by and large, we're talking about the writing that we're doing. And whereas Facebook has every distraction known to man on it, so it's that's actually why recently I brought the narrator and some other, and actually even the person who does the newsletter. Our newsletter is in Slack now because it's not Facebook. So that's probably a pretty important thing too. And there are people out there that have various and sundry other chat programs like Slack and whatnot that they're using for writers to work together. I've seen a couple of people post in the 20 books to 50K group that they run those as well.
It's interesting. I think we, Darlene and I, are pretty lucky to live in a city with, like, we're tripping over writers groups, but Molly left us recently and now she's in the land of no writers groups.
I know, it's so sad.
It's something I've thought about.
I live in Boston, which, you know, has the highest density of universities and colleges in the United States, and there are no writers groups here. It's really bizarre.
But you have Grub Street Writers Workshops, and I'm super jealous.
I don't even know about that. Maybe there's something here.
Oh, Literary City. Yes, you need to check out Grub Street Writers. They're amazing. Someday, cool. Word crafters will grow up and be this tiny little baby Grub Street.
Well, I think we've... this has been great. We've been talking for much longer than we typically do, so we really appreciate that. I think it's time to wrap things up. One thing we usually like to do is, you know, end each interview with a little bit of inspiration for writers who are striving to master their craft. What last piece of wisdom would you like to leave the interview with? And this can be the best piece of advice you've ever received, a quotation that drives you, or advice you might give folks who are coming to you asking for questions. A song or slam poem if you're so inspired, but I'm going to say no, don't do that.
Yes, you don't want that.
Someday I want someone to do an interpretive dance.
Interpretive dance on the podcast.
It's not going to be me. Yeah, that would not be
interpretive tap dance.
Spoons. I think that the most important thing, so I mean, when you think about writing and the struggles we've all gone through, like I started writing books when I was 10 years old and never finished anything. You get a little ways in and you didn't know what the heck you're doing, and you would leave it, and you end up with like this stack of incomplete manuscripts, and you start to feel like after a while, like, I don't know how to finish a story. So the thing I tell people the most is to get to the end. Start writing that story and don't look back until you get to the end, until you write those words at the end, because that will prove to you that you can do it. And I still remember the first time I ever wrote the end, where I completed a story. It was my Buffy season 8 fan fiction story that I wrote, which has long since been lost to the hard drives of time. When I did that, I was like, I can actually finish a story. You know, I had a climax, I had a conclusion, if I read it now, I'll probably be horrified, but it was a very empowering thing to get to the end. But I think too many authors or writers, they don't push themselves to get there. And that sort of ties into my write every day thing. Like write every day, even if it's just a little bit, write every day and get to the end and don't look back until you do, because that will feel so good that you have now this completed story. And you might look at it and say, I need to change all sorts of things, but you have things to change. Someone once, I'm sure this is someone famous and awesome, they said, a lot of times when you're writing your first draft, what you have to remember is you're just shoveling sand into the sandbox so you can make sandcastles later. That's a great way to think of it. You're like, this is crap, this is garbage. It's like, it is. But after I get to the end and I know what the heck I'm doing with the story, I can come back and I can hone all the stuff and I can refine it and I'll make it into a great story. So there you have it.
Absolutely. Well, thank you. Where can readers and fans find you, or what is the best place for them to find you?
They can go to aeon14.com. That's aeon14.com. See all the books that are up there, what's going on. And then we also, the fans and myself, hang a lot on Facebook. If you just search for aeon14 fans on Facebook, you'll find the fan group as well.
All right, great. Well, thank you very much. Really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us today.
You bet. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks. Yep.
Thanks,
we'll talk to you later.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right.